Zena.
And I'm Renee.
Welcome to When You Just Want a Glass of Wine, a podcast dedicated to making wine drinking more approachable and inclusive. Join us as we decode the language and unlock the customs of wine drinking. Cheers.
Cheers.
Yeah, this is a completely different, right? Yeah. I feel like I could blind taste this, but I'm probably full of myself because I wouldn't do it. But
that's got some tannins.
That's got some tannins in it. Okay, are we all ready for this this episode?
Let's go.
All right, welcome to When You Just Want a Glass of Wine and Guy Talk with Jimmy Taylor.
Yeah.
Cheers, everybody.
Woo. Cheers.
Woo. Cheers. Cheers. All right. This is going to be a fun one. We have a couple of things that we're working with. But first of all, we are going to introduce, you all should know by now, Jimmy Taylor, mechanic, Jimmy. A wine lover.
Yes, yes,
yes,
I am.
All over those things.
All true.
Snowboarder.
snowboarder extraordinaire.
Part-time gardener when necessary.
That's right.
Beauty, champagne, sugar.
We got tomatoes we have to plant.
23rd and Fern.
23rd and Fern.
A little blue house.
But we also want to introduce our good friend, Jeff Hartman, who is here with us today. Cheers to Jeff. Thank you for joining us. Look at this is how it works. We just keep cheering away. Jeff is one of our Beatza Wine Club members. He passed his WSET level 1 with 100. He is doing this episode Perfect. After doing a What's in Renee's Glass, a little challenging. So, Jeff, we're going to start. We all have wine in our glasses. This is a bold wine. So I want you all to – this isn't meant to be a tasting of, like, what's in your glass. This is more meant to be something kind of fun. If anybody has an idea – by anybody, I mean not Renee, but Jimmy or Jeff – if you have an idea of what this is, Dejected. Throw it out there. Because I think you might get it.
I think it's a cab.
No, you'd be wrong. So, but throughout the time, if you want to throw out like tasting notes, I've had it open for 45 minutes. I think it's going to continue to change as we taste it. If somebody has an idea of what they think it is, throw it out. And then we'll open it and reveal it. Feel free to pour some more because it's Sunday. And so I don't have to work tomorrow, so.
I can tell you this is probably closer to a Merlot because it is dark, it has plum, and it's right up my alley.
Yeah. So I will say, Jimmy, your taste buds have been spot on. Plum is an absolute descriptor of this. But let's get started.
I even got plum on
this.
Plum. And that's my least.
She is not. Renee is not good with stone fruit. You are not good with stone fruit.
There's no melon. We're okay.
Yeah, no melon.
Really,
that's right.
Melon.
All right, Jeff. First question we toss out to you. What made you want to get a little bit more into the world of wine? And how has your relationship evolved? And I say that because, you know, you started coming here and now you come more often, you're drinking more, you did your WSET, you know, along with some other of our wine club people. So how has your relationship with wine changed and evolved?
I think it was kind of a gradual process till recently where, you know, like I think a lot of people, I drank wine, you know, in college and kind of afterwards, but you didn't really know anything about it. So you just kind of drank what was available and you didn't know enough to know, like, it's good or bad. He's having a good time, right?
You go into the store, you're like, 20 bucks. Yeah, let's give it a shot.
I didn't have 20 bucks in college. And I was drinking Genesee beer.
I didn't go to college, so it's okay.
But then as you get older and you have some money from working a job, you're just like, maybe I should learn something about this. Actually, like, you know, buy good wines. So you kind of get into it that way, but there's a kind of a gulf between that stage where you know just enough to, like, know what you like, a total wine or whatever, pick it up, and then the point you're like, I actually want to go take a class about this. And for me, that's just kind of like friends of mine who are, you know, level 3s and very educated wine people taking
me out. Hi, Kristen.
Yes, Kristen.
May have twisted your arm slightly for 4 consecutive weeks here.
Peer pressure, yes. But yeah, I mean, talking to those sort of people and learning just what's out there and what there is to learn about that is kind of interesting. And then you take a class, and I did get peer pressured into it. But once you do it, it's actually pretty fun. And you're like, it's...
I might have helped with that. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Sorry about that.
What was one of the most fun, most interesting things you learned in the class?
It was interesting just learning. I'm more focused, I think, on how wine is made. That's what interests me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm not as good at tasting as some.
You are
does.
From the Midwest.
Yeah,
that farmer is still in you, isn't it?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Shout out Midwest.
Well, just, like you said, the technique that goes into that. I mean, a lot of work goes into making wine.
Kristen always makes fun of me because I'm really into the geology side of it. Like,
what
kind of soil do they grow in, which is
soil geek right here. Yeah. Soil geek
nerded,
right
we
here.
We nerded out on that on Pinot Noir.
Totally agree with
I'm
you.
More in the machinery side. Like, I would have liked to, you know, crush grapes with my feet or...
That's not machinery.
Well, yeah, but I
but getting also pressed, my, concrete my egg former, versus stainless, yeah.
Yeah, my former boss, you know, he's...
Oh, Joe.
He's
hey, Italian. Joe.
Yeah, Joe Basili, shout out. He and his family would make wine, and he and his dad got a press. They would go over every year, press the grapes out, you know, rerun it through the press to make sure all the stems and everything were out and come up with different
whole cluster.
And then the whole family
cluster right
would,
there.
Yeah. Well, the whole family would make the wine differently too. So like he would make it in the oak barrel. He kept it basically in the cellar. His father would do it in glass and kept it in the shed out
in
back.
In glass or in? In
glass.
In glass. Like the bigger glass.
Big
like
glass
the,
container, like, oh, like 5 gallon yeah. container. And then his brother would put it in stainless steel and keep it in the garage.
Well, there you go.
So every year, you know, they'd get together and taste their wine when it would come out. And some years was good. Some years, you know, it was great
that's,
flavored moonshine.
That's interesting.
There you go. Okay. So let me ask you, start you guys off, Jimmy, before we hand this over to you, because this is something we talk about, actually, at Wine Club all the time. Do men and women drink wine differently?
Yes. I drink it with my pinky out. I don't know about you guys.
You do seem very fancy when you
well,
do
that.
You do look fancy.
Honestly, it's just because my hands are so big, the pinky just doesn't fit.
That's go. True, with
that
the tiny glasses.
Taking this picture, right? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, is that a myth, or do you think men and women drink differently in general?
I don't think it's as... big of things it used to be, but I do think women are less self-conscious about drinking wine and like what they choose, you know.
That's fair.
True.
I know you've discussed before like men and rosé, that was a very real thing, and just kind of the idea of do you just drink red wine, is that the manly wine, which no, it's silly, but
yeah,
I think that's going away, you know, kind of as wine becomes more popular, but I definitely think that did exist and still exists to a certain extent.
Absolutely.
I think men are getting more comfortable with it.
Yeah.
I would put it more women treat wine like men treat beer. We're just like, hey, let's give it a shot. I don't know if I like IPAs or not. Let's go for it.
Let's that one's hazy.
Chardonnay.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's do that.
So I would say women treat wine like men treat
that's
beer.
That's a good thing.
Yeah. I was thinking of something like in preparing for this episode too. One of the things I thought of was popped into my head because I have a very dear friend whose family's from Sicily, and as a gift once I got him a Coppola wine basket. Because the first time I met him, he had a Godfather poster in his office. And I was
Coppola's
like,
Claret
Godfather so drinks wine. The Godfather drinks wine. And Francis Ford Coppola is one of the preeminent winemakers in California. And so I'm like, I feel like that's like the connection in with guys. It's like, it's the Godfather. Like
oh, yeah.
Cannoli and wine.
Yep. Like oh, we went there with my friend Chris, and we drank his Francis Ford Coppola Claret I've always enjoyed. But I did a lot of tasting before I was, let's say, in the industry. And we went there, and I had sardines with my wine. It was not the prettiest afternoon, but thank God Chris was driving. all right, so one last question, and then we're turning it over to Jimmy to lead. Where are we on this tasting? Anybody has any notes? Jeff, you need a little bit more in your glass. What are you thinking? What are you thinking about this? What do you get out of it?
I mean, the first thing I notice is very tannic, which I like a lot. Yep. So that's appealing to me.
My habit.
Yes.
It doesn't actually seem that dark, the color. So it's a strange combination, very tannic, but kind of... Looks like a lighter-bodied wine if you just look at it.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. It's lighter, it seems, than the Chianti we had, don't you think?
I don't think it's lighter than the Chianti. I think it's got a little more purple tint to it, but...
Oh, that's a good way.
This is a chewy wine.
Chewy is a good word.
This is a chewy wine.
Please explain. What do you mean by chewy?
It's got definitely that... The tannin, for sure, when you're in that, where you're like, wow, that's a very plush wine. So if this were a Pinot Noir, I would say that it was more New World than Old World. Because the New World would be a slightly warmer climate and have, you get that plushness, but it's also fruit forward. But this is dark. It's just dark. This reads dark all the way to me. Dark fruit,
yeah.
Dark plums, dark.
All right, I'm gonna give you all a little hint there.
That I'm
could
wrong.
Could it be?
Could be totally wrong.
No, could it be?
Definitely an oak, too.
Could it be how it was produced that's giving you both the flavors and that fruit profile. Now,
sure,
think about that. Well, Jimmy, why don't you start us off on the rest of Guy Talk, and then we'll, as we're taking a pause, I'll ask a few more questions, and we'll keep going.
Okay. Yeah, I can do that. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
I'm good, Jimmy. How are you?
Welcome to see and welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Long-time listener, first-time caller.
That's great.
So I just want to start you off. We're sitting here talking about wine and everything else. Is there anything that you actually hate about wine?
I mean, hate's a strong word.
Hate, okay, dislike.
I mean, there's
hate is a strong word.
there's definitely barriers, I think, to getting into wine that once you get over them don't seem so bad. But definitely when you're first learning about wine, it's a bit overwhelming, just the different regions and the different types of wine. And is the description on the bottle, is that a region or a grape, like depending on which country you're in, you don't know those things at first, and it's very overwhelming, which I think nobody likes being overwhelmed. I think I'm the kind of person, like, once you get over that port, over the initial learning curve, it's actually kind of cool that there's a lot to learn about it, but that's definitely kind of a hurdle when you're first getting into wine, just like you're so lost about most of the things.
So, yeah, I agree. I definitely have not gotten into it as far as regions, everything else, and you guys are all soil. Well, I've gotten into
what, you do like soil. A little soil. You have learned about soil.
Recently. Yes. Recently. Until recently.
What's your favorite soil?
Volcanic.
It is good, huh?
Yeah, it is good.
Volcanic. It's very good. It's very manly.
What kind of climate do you like better?
I like a cold climate.
Yeah, look at this. Isn't that that's the sexiest thing in the world when a guy knows what kind of climate he likes? That's how women drink wine differently.
Because he's a snowboarder. That's right. Why.
Yeah. Man, it tastes like there's fresh snow in this one.
You might need to have a little tattoo of this some wine on your arm. Snow. With it.
Oh, my.
With
the,
this one would be great in snow in front of a fireplace.
Oh, yeah. This great. One, yep.
Fireplace mm-hmm. wine right there.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a fireplace.
It's definitely, food, winter food friendly. Yep.
So getting into the regions and everything else, I've never really gotten into that. I do have preferences that I've learned that I like, but that came years later. So what regions do you like particularly?
I mean, I definitely have favorites. I think it's more just like, what do you kind of, my regions are more based on like the wines I would try, and I'd find one I really liked, and like you realize, like I really like white wines from volcanic soil, like the Greek islands, like Santorini. Mm-hmm. Really.
Who doesn't?
Like. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's a case where I think most things from that area, like there's some diversity, but it's a small enough region that like if I like this wine from this region, I probably am going to like other wines from this region, which is useful there. I think Italy is another example where I really like northern Italian reds from like the Venice and Piedmont areas, which has more diversity, I think. But still, it's like you kind of know what you're getting for the most part.
Yeah.
So it's safe to be like, oh, if I've had this winery, I haven't had this one, but I'm assuming they're kind of similar-ish, so you can feel safer buying it in a store. Like, you know what you're getting.
Yeah.
I think France is a difference where French regions are so diverse. It's kind of, you got to know what you're talking about in France, right?
I love how he's comfortable with Italy, but not France, right?
Well, but France, I think, you know, like one of the things we've talked about in the past is that wines can be a little intimidating because of like the sort of the snobbish, fussy factor. And I think the French are world renowned for that. Yeah. And their wines are some of the most expensive wines, if not the most expensive wines in the world. So I think, I mean, I even said like that I came to French wines later just because I couldn't afford them for a very, very, very long time. But
I'm
you can
not
afford.
Even sure I've had French wines.
Italian wines. Like you can afford some really nice Italian wines, and you can afford like really nice Spanish wines, and that's what I started in. Like so.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I agree.
I think it's a useful shortcut. Like if you find one wine you like, it's worth trying other wines from that region because you're probably going to like them too.
I think I started out in Italian wines myself.
Yeah. It makes something like
it's probably because of Joe too.
I'm sure.
Because, you know.
And it makes something as chaotic as Italy a little easier. It's like. Yeah. You're not learning all Italian wines. You're learning, oh, I had a Nero d'Avola. I'm going to try more Sicilian wines.
Yeah, well, and that's that manageable. Volcanic soil, too, that Sicilian wine.
Well, my boss used to laugh at me because I would bring lasagna in, and being straight up Sicilian, he was always like, what is that? What lasagna? He goes, that's not lasagna. And then I'd take a bite, and I'm like, tastes like my mom's home cooking. Yeah. And then he would take a bite of my lasagna, and he goes, this tastes like it came from Costco. I was like, right, my mom's home cooking.
Wait, he did like my lasagna.
Yeah, he did.
I think I brought it once to him, and he did like my lasagna.
That's high praise. Yeah.
All right, before we move to the next questions, anybody have any movement on this wine? Because we're getting to the point where I'm going to have to reveal it.
Ooh, is this one of the, you talked about the, so this is me doing deductive reasoning.
Go ahead. I'm going to let you go for it.
Is it finished in multiple ways? In other words, like a cement cask, cement or clay oak.
It's definitely finished in oak.
That is.
It's got oak, but did it start someplace else?
No.
That's what I was thinking.
You know, it's something of all the aging I have it's more about the style than about
where it was housed.
Carbonic.
Yeah. No. Interesting. You're missing something really important on this. So everybody take one sip. Let's take one sip together.
missing something.
In the style, we might be going off on. Debbie said has very specific definitions of the word style.
That's okay, but let's take Debbie said off the table for this one because it's guy talk. What's the biggest thing that you notice about this?
Right in the middle of the taste, there's something sweet going on.
Oh, interesting. That is so not far off.
Not the front end, not the back. I don't know proper term. Sorry, guys, but right in the center. When it hits the buds, there's definitely some sweet note that's hitting me, but I don't know what it is.
Like a dried?
No, almost more fruit. Like strawberry.
Oh, yeah. I do taste that, actually.
Right in the center of the sip.
Yeah, so this is going to be, this will be oaked and then and aged. So I'll give you one more hint.
It's definitely
to
oaked.
Me, it's not just the complexity, it's the richness of it and the fact that you're getting some... Would you say fruit on it?
Fresh, yeah.
Right?
Right, ripe fruit.
Means it's probably been something about how it was picked and produced.
Oh, they weighed it.
No, that's the carbonic that you were going with. All right, should we do a reveal so we can enjoy the rest of Guy Talk with wine in front of us?
Yes.
Not the way to, oh, you mean like late harvest?
Yeah.
Look at it. Yeah.
Kind of,
yeah.
Sort of.
What? Old vines.
Getting closer. But
all right,
come on, Renee. We're relying on you.
She's
for this.
Shutting me down on all my Debbie said stuff today, so I'm like, I'm over it. I'm done. I don't want to guess anymore.
What were the regions that you said were your favorite regions in it? Regions.
Venice was my first love.
There you go. So Veneto. This would be from Veneto. What is one of your favorite wines?
It was Rapasso.
Yes, except this. What was the wine you said you wanted to drink but you hadn't?
Oh, it's Amarone.
An Amarone.
Well, that's why I didn't know it.
I never would have gotten
there
that
there you
either,
go.
Right?
Okay. So what goes on here is this is what they call an apasamiento method, where the grapes...
That's what I said, and you were like, no.
Did you say apasamiento?
I said apasamiento. You're like, no. I'm like, okay.
Oh, I didn't hear that. I'm sorry. I thought you said something else.
That's okay. That's
oh, I
okay.
thought you said... I'm sorry. I thought no, you said no, something no. else. I'm a, that's, and right. that's like the Chenin Blanc thing where, you know, that that's was my okay. mistake. Yes.
No, so no, totally fine.
I thought you said something that didn't go towards that. So, yeah, the grapes are dried before they're fermented, and this is where you get this richness. So you're also you're tasting that fruit from that as well. The black cherry of it is just incredible. It can age Amarones for a long time. They are full-bodied, right? This is probably one of the most full-bodied we have.
Age Amarones. Can you explain that, please?
Well, you could age this for 10, 15, 20 years.
You can lay it down in the bottle.
You can lay it down. I mean,
and 43 minutes?
43 minutes.
You could do 10, 20 years on some Amarones, right? But it's very full-bodied. It has higher alcohol. I don't know. What are we looking at on this actual one? Can you see that, Jimmy?
16.5%.
Ooh, hey.
Yep.
Yeah. That
you
is
get
not
some,
a light drinking wine.
The fruit on it is dried. It tastes more like dry cherry because of the way they do it, but it really coats your mouth. That's where I was trying to get it. It's really mouth-coating. It has... It's very, very flavorful. So you harvest them, you dry them for 3 to 4 months, then you press them gently, and then you can age them before it goes into the bottle. So I wanted to get something because prior to this, we talked about you wanting to have an Amarone.
I know, I'm very honored.
Yeah, so this kind of, just because we're, you know, I think it's helpful, especially in the Guy Talk thing.
Well, since this is Guy Talk, I'm going to call you out on one thing you just said. Yeah. Being a mechanic, I don't think there is such a thing as pressing gently.
That's why you work with cars and not grapes, right? So this is
we press this gently in our 10-ton press. It's okay.
This is a Bagale Amarone della Valpolicella Classico DOCG 2020. It would retail at about $50.
Nice.
You'd probably find it in a restaurant for $125, $130. If you like Amarones, anything in that range would be a perfectly good range for it. Thank you, Andrew Stover, for finding this for us.
Yes, thank you.
Now yeah. I am going to let Jimmy continue on, but I'm going to pour all of us more of this. I really wanted to treat you, Jeff, to something that you had wanted to try, so yeah. I hope you enjoy it.
Thank you.
Yeah, cheers.
It's very, very good.
They're very distinctive wines.
I'm going to get right on this since we're drinking it, and you just gave us price points on that. What do you think about that price point, Jeff? Like $50 in a retail store? I would consider it. But if I'm at a restaurant at 120 to 125.
I mean, that's part of the reason I've never had an Amarone before.
And it's usually, I mean, that's if you're fair. Thinking about how it gets to that, it's like kind of a 2.5 is what you might see. So if you see something in a retail shop, it's kind of going to be about 2.5 in the restaurant. Really depends. And I'm not talking about a buy the glass one. I'm talking about a buy the bottle. Buy the glass usually has like a flip of 4 times. Yeah. So that's, so if you see something retail at 50, if you're like Googling it and you're like, I can get that for 50 and it's 125 in the restaurant, you're actually doing okay. That's, you know you're not being overcharged for it.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because if I was the younger me who didn't know that much about wine, saw a $50 bottle of wine in the shop, I would have been like, no, that's outrageous. But now I'm like, I know how good Amarones are and how expensive they are. If I saw a $50 bottle, I'd be very tempted, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's, I'm also like, I kind of be, I don't drink wine at home as much as I think other kind of like wine people do. I like to be more social and drink it out, and that definitely makes it up with like, you got to be comfortable with paying the kind of the bottle price at restaurants, which.
Yeah, that's true.
Can't be a sticker shock, but you have someone like Zini explaining to you, like, I enjoy that side too, is like just knowing how the pricing works. It's like, oh yeah, that actually is a fair price.
You ever gone out to eat with Zina and Renee? It's definitely sticker shock.
Yeah, I think Jimmy treated both of us. That was Sarah. Time. That was a lot.
But
funny.
I ordered the wine, and
that
I
was
gonna,
the wine.
I was like, I was going to pull the credit card out. Like, if I'm ordering that wine, then I'm like, I'm expecting to pay.
Yeah. That was
but
Lopez
thank you
Santa
for that.
Idea.
That was very generous. But I was like, I never order an expensive wine unless I'm expecting to pay.
Right. No, it was a great experience.
By the way, a side note on that before we get back into it, when my dearest friend Wendy Gordon and I were just up in Philadelphia and we ate at Vernick Food and Drink, where her son Mike, shout out to Mike and Vernick, is the bartender there. And we were looking at the wine list and I sent it over to Renee. There was the Lopez de Heredia. But there was the Lopez de Heredia, what was it, the 1995 that was $795 or something like that?
Yeah.
And there was the more reasonable ones that were in the hundreds. So next time we go back, we'll have Mike make us a rye cocktail. Because we love that, but we might have to just go for the Lopez de Heredia.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's why we do the hard work that we do. Yeah. To get paid to wear things that we love.
I'll have Mike's cocktail.
He makes a good cocktail, man.
They are definitely great.
But anyhow, continue on guy talk. Sorry, that was just a little aside there.
No. We did pretty good. So you're going out to a restaurant, you're not going to shine away from the 120 price point.
I mean, as you get to know more about wine, I'm more tempted.
More tempted, yeah.
But it's got to be the right kind of wine, right?
It does have to be the right.
If you see like an Amarone or a Barolo, like the really expensive
Brunello,
but great Italian wines, you might be tempted to pay that. But I'm definitely not the kind of guy who goes and is like, I'm just going to take the most expensive bottle because it's the most expensive bottle, which seems a bit silly a lot of times.
When you go through the wine list now, do you look at what's there or do you kind of put your finger down that price list and just kind of scroll down?
I mean, I've gotten better about it, I think, as I've learned more. I used to be, like, going back to regions, I'd be like, I'd go into a wine, like a long wine list, and I would skip the French ones because they didn't know enough to like know what was.
Many of us do. It is true.
I'd go to like the Italian or Spanish or Greek and be like, oh, I've had something like this before. So, and then you might, if there's two or three options, I would be like, I'm not going to get the most expensive one. I'm not going to get the cheapest one. I'll get the middle one, you know? I mean, there's no logic to that. But you're like, maybe that's the best value for money. But
yeah.
But as you learn more wine, you can kind of be like, oh, I've actually had that.
Yeah, and you know it
that
tastes
great before.
No, it tastes
that wine
good and
before, and that makes it a lot easier to just be like, I've had this wine before. I know it's good. Like, I'll pay that price. That seems like a fair price.
That's why I can get the Chianti Classico. Yeah.
Well, the more expensive wine it is in both the wholesale and retail, in many ways, not 100%, but in many ways, we always talk in generalities, you're going to get a kind of a better value. It's like when you get veal in a restaurant, the joke is always like, never order veal if you're the restaurant owner, like when your friends come in, because veal costs you so much, you make so little on it.
Yeah.
You know, order pasta, please, because that costs me nothing and I can charge $35 a plate. But, you know, once we're getting into a steak or a veal, it costs a lot of money. So a higher priced wine is going to have a lower markup, both in the retail shop and in the restaurant in general. Because you can't do that same type of a percentage increase.
I think that works in any industry, because even in the automotive, we do the same thing. The more expensive the part, the less the markup is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're talking about a 5-cent bolt or light bulb, like we have a 200% markup on it.
You're talking about my Mercedes wipers.
But then it turns out to only be like 25 cents, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Well, and you're talking about the quality, too. I mean, we just talked about a little bit about what goes into making an Amarone.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like it's such an involved process. And you get it in WSET 2 where they actually have photos of them, of the grapes drying in these barns and everything, and how they're drying in them and everything that goes through it, and like how you have to take care of that and keep everything away from it and everything, that it's more labor intensive, so it increases the price.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a curated, skilled wine.
The more difficult it is. Yeah. I mean, our big joke in our industry is, you know, sometimes you got to go in and it costs a buttload. To replace that 5-cent part that broke.
That's right. Everything comes out.
So, Jeff, do you think wine can feel intimidating to people?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah?
What? I think we've kind of hit on two of the things. Just one, there's the learning curve up front. There's just so much to know about wine.
And you've taken your W set?
Well,
yeah.
Wisset.
Wisset.
Wisset. No, W set is the correct. Right? Yeah.
It's weird comparing because Renee is a level two, and just the amount she had to learn for the level two compared to the level one is...
She carries around a book of smelling things.
Yes.
Nez de vin. I was. It does go up by level. It goes up exponentially. Like, I think level one, they say you spend 6 hours. And so I was like, level two, this would be a piece of cake, 6 hours. And they're like, level two, you spend 26 hours. And I'm like, that's getting closer to a part-time job.
Yeah. And then you said, should I do level three? And I said, no, we're starting a podcast.
And so then I am going to do it, but in the fall. But that's why we're doing all the blind tastings, because level three is 10 weeks, and it's like 80-some hours of study. But
I recommend level one. It's a fun afternoon.
It is a fun afternoon. Yeah, exactly.
Not very stressful. You don't have as much homework as you had for level two. But yeah, so you have that learning curve, and then you also have, I think Renee touched on it, like, I think it's gotten better, but there is kind of the snobbish reputation of some wine lovers that's a little off-putting, I think, as someone coming in. It's like, you know, it's bad enough that you have to learn these things just to, like, kind of know what you're doing, but then to have, you think, people looking down on you for not knowing those things is a little intimidating.
Yeah, that's no fun.
But I think it's gotten better.
Well, what's one thing you wish people knew that would make them feel less snobbish? Or make it all feel less snobbish. Right, I'm sorry.
I mean, honestly, I think it's... I don't know if it's maybe an American thing, but I feel like Europeans aren't that way. It's like...
Europeans definitely are not.
It's such a part of your culture over there. Yeah. It's like, once you understand that, they're not snobbish about wines. It's part of their life and their culture.
It's their water.
Everyone drinks it. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just normal. When do you learn that? It's like, well, it's some American guy. Like,
they go home. They go home for lunch, and they look sit at there that, and I mean, have a Greek salad and wine and come back and go work.
Yeah, it's not something that someone should be snobbish about. So if they're looking down on you, that's their problem. It's not yours, you know. It's just like...
Excellent point. I like that.
Do you feel like you say that now that you're more comfortable in wine because your wine journey is ongoing?
I mean, it was also different because I started drinking wine overseas. I mean, I was in Japan when I first kind of started drinking wine.
That's an interesting place to start drinking. Yeah.
That's because all of my... I was on an English language teaching program. We had lots of
Australians. Oh, I did that in Taiwan.
Oh, yeah. We had lots of Aussies and people from New Zealand there.
Oh, so they knew wine.
Yeah, like one of my best friends is from Blenheim, kind of the white country of the South Island. So they brought these, not great wines, but like good wines, you know? Like, that's kind of my first exposure. And then I like went to Montreal, you know, to visit people and have wine up there. So I don't think I got the American experience right off the bat. I'd already kind of like learned about things.
You were learning from wine from people that loved wine and like really went in. And I think it's absolutely right. And you can be around fun wine people and you just have to find them sometimes.
Yeah. Speaking of that, we were talking about this prior to, who's someone you mentioned to me that you see drinking wine now that's helping to break that barrier?
That'd be LeBron James. Arguably the greatest of all time, although I've still picked Michael Jordan, but it's getting closer. LeBron's having a great career at 40, but... Yeah, we talked about this because...
They can both be great, you know? And
they can both be great.
They both are. It's kind of a silly argument, but you got to mention that, of course. But no, like, I was watching his podcast last week because Luka Doncic was on there. He was on again today. They had the second episode, and it was interesting because, like, I know they've been drinking red wine, but, like, they don't even talk about it now. Like, you think normally, back in the day, they would have made a big show about, like, oh, here's the wine we're drinking, blah, blah, but it's so ingrained. Like, they were just like, yeah, we're just casually sipping red wine.
Do they drink red wine every time?
Yes.
And it's red wine?
Yes.
So that's interesting too. They're still not drinking red wine rosé or Chardonnay. They're still sticking on that kind of almost stereotypical men drinking red.
I think it's that. I also think from doing a little bit of reading about this, I think LeBron's really on the health benefits of red wine. And as someone who's 40 years old trying to play in the NBA, I think he's probably very dialed in on what he thinks is
He probably doesn't drink a lot. Mm-hmm. He probably just has like.
And when he drinks, he's probably drinking something really nice.
He's something focused on.
Do they have it in the
glass
notes?
A glass a day keeps the doctor away.
That's right.
Do you ever know what they're drinking?
That's why I fill up a pitcher.
That's right.
And I actually checked today. They don't even put it in the notes. So.
Interesting.
Yeah. But I saw Wine Enthusiast had a good article, which I hadn't seen before, just going into like how the NBA became a wine drinking league. And it's at the point now where they don't even mention it. It's just kind of, it's normal for us to be drinking red wine and having a conversation.
That's funny.
Which 20 years ago, I think that would have been noticeable.
Yeah.
The fact they were drinking wine and not beer.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, culture has definitely changed on that, where you definitely see guys sitting down and drinking wine more than you ever used to. definitely would have beer before, but cocktail. Now you're saying
Manhattan
cocktail. Well, yeah, there's nothing wrong with a good Manhattan.
Nothing
at all. Yeah.
That was my grandfather taught me that.
That's why you love everything with a cherry in it.
As he would beat me playing pool, the more he had. That was my wise decision.
That is a superpower to play pool better.
I thought if he had more, like, he would get worse.
No.
The only problem is he was actually losing his eyesight. So in his older years, one day he was playing. We were playing, and instead of lining up at the cue ball, he lined up at the nine ball, and I didn't have the heart to tell him.
Wow. That's good but for you, yeah.
I don't think it would have made a difference. He still beat me.
Yeah.
So.
There you go.
It was a hard lesson. Like, get better.
Get better.
Do better. But he would drink Manhattan. He enjoyed a nice glass of red wine as well. Definitely like the plum flavor, and, you know, red fruit.
I mean, I think it's also interesting. Like, I think wine used to be seen more as like a special occasion type of drink.
Yeah,
red wine.
Very good point.
I think that's changing. Where
it can be more casual
in the U.S.
I mean, we're doing a wine podcast, so it makes sense. So we're drinking wine. Yeah. But professional athletes just talking about stuff, like, they don't have to choose wine. They can choose anything. That's what they're deciding to drink. It's just kind of like so normal to them that that's their default.
I do think that there's something, because somebody came in the other day and started asking me about, and she said fit wine when she first said it. And I was like, fit wine? And I'm trying to figure, like, I'm thinking, is this a German statement, like a German word or something?
What was it?
Fitness, like wines that are better for you because they're, it's all the myth stuff that we talked about, like there's no...
Somebody came in today and was like, I want to have wine, rosé wine, under 10% alcohol so I can drink it during the day.
And I'm like, is there such a thing? I thought all wine was like 12 or higher. Yeah.
No, you can find it, but it's going to... 12, yeah, for rosé, you're talking 12, 12 and a half is normal. And I was kind of like, then just, you know, have, but anyhow. So, yeah.
Maybe have a glass and not a whole glass.
All right, I'm going to open up this next question to all of you. How do you guys feel about, like, the rules in wine? Pairing red wine with meat, white wine with fish, anything like that. I'm not really all that traditional, and I will eat what I want and drink what I want.
Yeah. Jeff, go ahead with this one.
I mean, I'm torn at it because, like, on one hand, I don't like them because they're very confusing and it's hard to remember. Again, getting back to learning curve, or, like, pairing is one of the hardest things for me, just to know, like, what would go well with this meal based on, you know, the tasting profile. But then I've also had, like, servers at places, like, who really knew wine and would recommend pairings, and it does make a difference. Like,
oh, absolutely.
It's definitely real.
What would you eat with this that we, I mean, we talked a little bit about it, but what would you eat with the Amarone we're drinking right now?
I mean, it's pretty rich. I would think, you know, I hate to be conventional, but probably some sort of meat.
Yeah, I go with short rib is where my head keeps going towards. Some kind of rich, short ribby.
Puttanesca. Something with like a veal raviolini with a puttanesca.
I'm thinking like a good old bison burger and some grilled veggies.
Yeah, that is all good. It's all good.
I mean, I'm Nebraskan, so I would choose a steak. But
My mom's a cattle rancher. Only a good for dinner, the whole thing.
Though. What's for dinner?
I mean, we've talked about this a lot of things, but I always think that it's one of the things that I loved in the WSET training is that they're like, it's also palate preference. So pairings can help you enhance things, and the rules can help you enhance the flavor.
Yeah.
But if you don't like, one of their things is like cooked mushrooms, and a lot of cooked mushrooms. And if you don't like mushrooms like me, then you're going to be like, or melon. They're like, this would be amazing with prosciutto and melon, and I'm going to just push it away because it's got melon in it and I don't want it. And so I think that's where like the rules, I like them more as recommendations.
I like the, for the wine club option for Thanksgiving, I pulled the Weiss Gewürz, which I think both of you, I don't know if you both drank it, but we had it, and I thought a Gewürz with Thanksgiving meal was great, especially the Weiss Gewürz. I thought that was a really interesting pairing, and I don't think people think Gewürz for Thanksgiving. Oh, we want to talk terroir, don't we?
We do want to talk terroir.
I'm all about the geology. Let's do this.
Can you
He's like, I'm in. Let's
terroir,
go.
Like if someone's cool aunt just wanted to drink something tasty? Jeff?
Yes?
Yeah. Can you explain it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the local conditions. It's like a less fancy way of saying it.
Yeah.
Saying it in English. I mean.
It's the farmer in you, right?
I was going to say, in Nebraska, that'd be easy to explain. It's like. Yeah, if you grow
I'm not
corn,
from Nebraska.
If you grow corn on this side of the hill, it's going to get more sun, it's going to get more water, and the soil is different. People, yeah, I understand that. So maybe if you're not from a farm state, but yeah, it's just like the local conditions, and everybody knows, at least where I'm from, it's like, certain parts of your farm are better for growing certain things, and you realize that over time. And
but you're talking about from everything, from soil conditions to sunlight to wind.
Yeah, I mean, rain, where does the water collect, you know, how much erosion do you
get? Exactly how
long. Runoff and everything.
And that's one of the cool things about wine is it's, you have these families who've been working the same land for generations, and they've really dialed that in.
Oh, yeah.
Even if they can't really explain exactly why. I mean, I think they can now. Some of these wineries are so scientific about this, but even back before they knew why, they had just figured out from
trial and error. They figured it out from trial and error, yeah.
Which is very cool, like, that they know that this hillside in Piedmont is perfect for growing our Barolo grapes because the sunlight is perfect, the precipitation is perfect, the soil is great for this. Like, yeah.
Oh. You were talking about Greek wines earlier, and I sent Zena something earlier, and it was a thing that an Assyrtiko, the way that they grow them, they train the vines to grow in a circle around to protect the grapes from the wind coming off the coast, coming off the ocean. And because otherwise it could be too windy and it can be really harsh and destroy them. And they literally train the vines in these circles. And that's how they do it. And like, that's that history of like, we've been growing grapes here since time immemorial, and this is the best way. And you get these amazing Assyrtiko Greek wines, the high acid white wines and everything, that are amazing.
Oh, I've literally seen a little tornado winds that they talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
The Van Duzer, Van Duzer corridor in the Willamette Valley. Was,
like 3 o'clock, just comes right through. That was really cool. We were actually tasting wine. It wasn't even in the vineyard. It was right next to us. And
I didn't get to see it. He saw it.
Our taster or representative. I'm sorry, I don't know who they're called. Whoever was helping us with the tasting, I literally got to watch the mulch right next to us in the walking path. Hey. And they're like, I've never seen it this close to our place. But it was just whipping it around, and mulch is just flying.
I love how Jeff described it, because it's such a it's both simplistic and intricate, right? It's really just, again, about farming and the fact that you talked about the hillside and where it could go. You see a lot of this, over in Napa, you know, the hillside selects, why that's important, the soil and all that. It's geeky, but it's also, like you said, if you're out from the Midwest, you're going to know what grows better in certain regions.
Oh, and some people, as you and I have discovered, they do get very scientific about it, very computerized. Yeah. Everything is mapped out. And then there are some people that are very traditionalist. Still collect it the old way, still take your chances, press it. So it's really neat going to different wineries and figuring it out.
Portugal was a really fascinating thing of that, because only recently did they figure out what they had by doing DNA testing of the grapes. Portugal is known for blends, because they never had enough of like one. So they just knew, okay, we'll take this much from this section of the hill and a little bit over here and a little bit here, and we'll put it all together.
Magic happened.
And it was three different varietals. They just had no idea what was planted there. Until recently, and they've done all this DNA testing on it, and it's kind of fascinating. And now they're being more scientific about it, and they're starting to like enhance their local varietals there, because they've got a lot of very unique.
And this goes back to what you were asking, Jimmy. This goes back to the rules, and you know what Renee and I say all the time, because of course we've learned this from other people, is, you know, eat the food from the region that of the wine that you're drinking.
Grows together, it goes together.
Grows together, it goes together.
Really?
Yeah. So if you're
drinking, is that one of the rules?
Yeah. It's not. It's a recommendation.
It's a really good idea.
It's a good idea. It sounds like a good idea.
If you're gonna have a really lovely Spanish wine and you're gonna have it with some Spanish ham, where the pigs have only eaten acorns on one hill, that's like proof that God loves you and wants you to be happy
That almost sounds like personal experience
there. Yeah, yes, it is.
A little Chianti Classico with a wonderful Italian dinner like we did at Thompson. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I've had some really good Italian dinners just at my shop with my boss.
There you go.
So on a date night, who's paying? Who's ordering, Jeff?
I mean, I'm older. I'm traditional, so I'm usually paying.
Yeah.
And as I think we discussed on previous episodes, like, it's kind of the expectation if you're paying, you're ordering, which, when you're just learning wine, can be a little bit of a nerve-wracking experience. Mm-hmm. You don't know that much, but it definitely gets better. I think there's just tricks involved, I think. Like, I think we discussed, like, my trick was always, I've had wines from this region. If I see that region, I'm like, oh, thank God. Like, I've had an Assyrtiko before. I know that I like this white wine. So
I love that he loves Greek wine. Yeah. It's just so interesting. Yeah.
Yes. The nerve-wracking part is if you get to someplace and you don't recognize any of the wines, then you're like, oh, man, I'm just like, paint blind.
But do you fake it till you make it, or do you continue on with that?
I'm pretty stubborn. I would have faked it, but I think the recommendation now to all younger men is just ask the sommelier.
That's a good recommendation.
You can do that in a way that makes you still seem cool and worldly. Well,
we're having or this what about for dinner. What are you having? Yeah.
What about asking maybe your date?
There's that. If your date, maybe your date knows a lot about wine.
I mean, I've actually had that situation before. I was trying to be cool, but my date turned out to know much more about wine than I did.
Not me.
I didn't find that out till later. She's very cool.
Zena doesn't know a thing about wine.
No, not a thing.
It's quite embarrassing when we go out sometimes.
Yes, of course you should ask them, like, especially if you don't have a good idea, just be like, oh, what wines do you like? And then hope that it's on
the
menu.
Do you like wine? Yeah.
Do you like wine? That's a great way to start.
Yeah. Well, I think the part where you said that you pick something that you know, but then you could also describe. So you said before you like that the Masi, the Ripasso, which is a very similar style to the Amarone. It's in some ways like a little baby Amarone, right? They don't do the full drying method. So you like that kind of intense flavor of it. And that's actually a really good wine to have in your back pocket because it's both an easy drinking wine, it's a little geeky, it sounds good, and if you say that to your somm or your server, this is the kind of style I like, even if that person, if it's a regular server, doesn't know what it is, they'll take it to the bartender, you can find something similar. So if you have an idea in your head that you can express, I like my favorite, you know, what I like to eat it, drink is a Masi Ripasso, I like it because it's medium bodied, it has this flavor profile, they'll find you something.
Masi Ripasso. Explain that to me, Jeff.
Actually, I can.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
I mean, we discussed earlier, like, I like the process of making wine. The Ripasso is interesting because they take the Valpolicella, like the local wine of Venice, which if you just do it by itself, it's usually like a table wine, which is when we were doing the Chianti tasting. Mm-hmm. It's like, you're like, it's a table wine. I'm like, oh, the only one I know is Valpolicella from Venice. But so they have that grape, which they use mostly for kind of lower cost wines.
Okay.
And then they have the Amarones, which are like these beautiful, expensive wines that are great, but not everyone can afford them. So the Ripasso is kind of this interesting technique of once you make the Amarone, you still have the skins from the grapes, which aren't going to have the same amount of flavor, but they still have a little bit of it.
Yeah.
So Ripasso is basically, they take this table wine, Valpolicella, the lower level one, they pour it over the grape skins to get a little bit of that Amarone flavor, and then they can sell, like she said, it's a baby Amarone. So you get a little bit of the flavor for less of a price, and it's like a good medium.
Medium body,
yeah.
And similar to these flavors, we're doing the fig, the cherry, those really pretty flavors. Mm. Yeah,
I like that about the Italians because Nick said the one thing where he said, the Italians get offended if the wine is too expensive. How am I supposed to drink that every day?
Oh gosh, yeah, no.
If you're gonna just make it that crazy, so
they would
like
to make
bring
every,
that back down. Yeah,
they would like to make every fountain like.
So they always have like the baby, that's the only place that you hardly ever see somebody talk about a baby Bordeaux. Or something
that's
like that.
That's true, right.
But you hear they're like, there's a baby Burl,
there's
a baby Brunello,
there's
a
baby Tuscan,
baby Amarone.
I like that you brought up figs, because I forgot, knowing my boss was Italian, he'd hate me because I cut down my fig plant. And he goes, you cut it down? And I was like, yeah. I didn't know what it was. It's like, it just used to produce this thing, and my son and I would throw it at each other. And he goes, you would just throw figs at each other. I was like,
oh my
gosh.
Literally food of the gods.
He goes, you got to start bringing that in. I was like, all right. So I actually start collecting it. He's like, why'd you cut it down? I'm like, because it was growing right next to the house. He goes, that's smart. Protected from the wind.
Protected from the wind,
why they never grow. And I'm like, but the roots are going into my brick.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't have that.
You're so good. That's awesome.
So, Jeff, what's your first memory of drinking wine? And was it love at first sip or... not so much.
Actually, I don't have a horror story because growing up in Nebraska, I really had never had wine much. My parents like still don't really drink wine. So my first real tasting was, you know, in Japan with kind of Aussies and Kiwis bringing over wine.
That's a fun way to taste, though.
I mean, to be fair, probably the first thing I ever had was probably Yellowtail, but.
We've all had Yellowtail.
Yeah.
But to be fair, if it's your first wine, it's not the worst. Like,
no. I had Yellowtail in Vegas in a restaurant called Yellowtail, and it was $12 a glass, so.
There's nothing wrong
with that. It should be $6.
There's a lot wrong with that.
Just like your socks, my cat and I are talking stuff about you right now. But we're not judging. We're not judging.
We're not judging.
Oh, we're judging hard.
But I guess my first real good tasting was, like I said, my girlfriend I met in Japan. She was from Montreal. So we came back to the States. Well, she's from Canada, obviously. So I went up to visit her in Montreal, and her father's one of the coolest people in the world, like former professional motorcycle racer.
Ooh.
This Irish guy. But he really loved wine. He's the one who gave me the Masi for the first time. I think I had it there, and I'm like, what is this? This is much better than Yellowtail.
Yes, it is.
And he also bottled his own wine. So I have very fond memories of, you know, sitting in the backyard in Montreal in the 2 weeks of summer.
Fast equipment, too.
Yeah, that's about all. Not in the 2 weeks. That's all Montreal really gets of summer is 2 weeks. Yeah,
I was there in the summer and the winter. And the summer is gorgeous.
They have all those
winter, not so much. But.
Summer is gorgeous. I've been in Montreal in the summer.
And they have those great festivals.
Yeah. I'm going to do a little rapid fire on you, if that's all right. And by is that all right? I know it's all right, because that's what I'm going to do to you. What do you sip when you're not trying to impress anyone, just chilling at home?
Like I said, I don't drink a lot at home, but I'm just like watching a game or something.
You said you're a social butterfly. You like to drink with other people.
Yeah. I'll go out and like I'll be at the – as long as there are other people around, it's okay, right? So I'll go to the bar and like watch a game. Like I've gotten into rosé a lot.
Yes, you have. I like that about you.
I realize if you're watching something, you don't want to be drinking red wine for too long.
Weird.
Rosé is very refreshing. It's good in the summertime, yeah.
Unfortunately, I have learned that, yes, it is.
Yeah, so that's
it's a day drinker because,
yes.
That's one thing being here. It's taught me that there actually is a rosé season.
And it's called the year.
Yeah, men should have learned earlier. Rosé is amazing.
Yeah.
Rosé is time amazing, yes.
What's your go-to bottle for date night?
I mean, we've already talked about that. I really like the Gavala Assyrtiko, which you can get at Mam Eugenie and other Greek restaurants around here. It's one of my favorites. And then I used to do the Masi a lot. I've branched out a bit, but I'll still like get that every once in a while. That used to be my go-to of like, oh, it's like a birthday party or someone's housewarming. It's a good bottle that's good enough that like it seems like I know about wine, but affordable enough that I'm like, yeah.
That's a great way to put it.
And if she breaks up with you, then what are you drinking?
Anything.
My man. Yeah. My man. Yes, anything.
Probably Manhattan's.
I was going to say, I'm reaching for the bourbon.
If I'm drinking rosé, I probably didn't care that much. If I'm really sad, I'm drinking Manhattan's.
Oh, well. That's bye. Good riddance.
Well, this Amarone is pretty strong. Maybe
right? I mean, I feel like I'm a, you know, this is the whole thing, right? That's what you, well, your point being very valid, that we've each just had a glass of it, and wow. I can feel it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to send this around real quick to everyone here at the table. This is going to be a real quick answer. What's your take on box wine, yay or nay? Jeff?
I'm actually not opposed to box wine. We discussed this one time. Like, for cooking, I love box wine just because I feel terrible opening a nice bottle of wine by myself. I know I'm not going to finish it at its peak.
Yeah.
Midwestern guilt. You've got to get over that. I feel it. I'm in the same place. I'm from Missouri, but I'm like, yeah. I'm like, no, get over that. Drink good wine when you're alone.
Well, I'm not drinking it. Like, I would much rather just have a box wine in my fridge.
Just to cook with.
And I don't feel bad if it, like, sits in there too long.
It can sit forever.
It's box wine. It's good. But like,
it depends on the box wine. I think they're getting better.
They're definitely getting better. Yeah.
Are you making the thing that I don't drink, sangria? If you're going to have a sangria,
I'm
going to throw it in there. I don't care because I'm not going to drink it.
Wait, I'm going to give you all a tip on box wine because when I lived in Australia.
Answer the question first. Yes.
Yes, I believe in it. When I lived in Australia with Steve, they would take the box wine and you would drink all the wine out of it, and then you would fill it back up with water, and then you would freeze that, and then you would use it in your cooler, so you can have multiple uses for boxed wine. There is nothing wrong with boxed wine. No. It's a time and a place thing, especially if you're in a pool or you're somewhere and you're just drinking.
You can't have glass.
Yeah, you can't have glass. I mean, you get something a little bit better than blah, but it's perfectly fine.
I was going to say, we used to take the bladder out, throw it in the cooler, and then we'd
same
go
concept.
To the, yeah, we'd go to the campfire, and we just...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
there you go.
Like you said, when you can't have glass or anything else, and you're just trying to have a good time and something decent.
Just get your nice Yeti water bottle that holds an entire bottle of wine.
Right.
Yep.
I always use
it. Not that I've ever done that, stuck that into a brewery for
me neither. Nor has anyone ever called me out at work when I'm leaving and I'm drinking out of my Yeti coffee cup, and they go, "We all know it's not coffee."
Yeah.
What about wine and takeout? Have you ever had an unexpected pairing that you're like, that actually went pretty well together?
I mean, yeah, I love Asian food. Mm-hmm. Asian food could be hard to pair wine.
What are you pairing with that?
Asian food can definitely be hard to pair with.
I find that like really acidic white wines tend to go well with kind of spicier, you know.
Like I got a couple ideas on that, but yeah. Like are you thinking like a Riesling? What are you thinking?
Riesling's all, yeah, that's a great choice, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like Thai food's always hard to pair with, I think. Japanese
your
food
Greek wines would be good with
your Greek wine.
I was going to say Greek, that's what came to my mind first. Is like Centurions. Really high acid Greek wine with spicy Thai food.
Oh, you know me, I'm a Finger Lakes off dry Riesling. That's where I'd be
petite
influenced.
Petite
Mansang also
a
good.
Dry or an off dry petite Mansang. We're going to have a wonderful one at Glen Manor on Thursday, but a petite Mansang Especially with like a lot of, if it's got some kind of dried fruit in it or as well, like that kind of a thing. But yeah.
I'm drinking champagne with my Asian food.
There you go. So proud. Our little boy's all grown up. Look at him.
Spring roll Barbersville.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
One of the greatest things I learned at Beauty is just like how well champagne goes with fried food.
Right.
It actually does.
Prepare for November. We're doing another one.
Which now that I know the concept, it makes complete sense. But mm-hmm. I never would have come to that on my own.
I still like the one we did where we did the pairing of wine and Girl Scout cookies.
Oh, yeah. That was really great. Yeah. I love it.
So what wine are you drinking with playoffs? Now, I'm going to give you a little hint. Steve, when he was on our show, he said beer.
He said beer.
Steve did. Steve also reps DC Brow. So
are you in that same boat, or do you actually have a wine that you would watch?
I think this question was my idea. So like, obviously, I don't know because I'm asking the question. I think here's the way I think about it: is that the issue with drinking beer during the playoffs is that I like a stronger beer, like an IPA or something. It's a little higher alcohol content.
Yeah.
But you also got to pace yourself because you got to watch four quarters of the
game. You do got to watch
if it's good, and that could be a struggle.
And those IPAs are. Powerful.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I would never drink this Amarone with a playoff game because
I've had one glass and we're already
you'll
like,
be gone by halftime, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So I would say probably.
That's generally why we drink, like,
amateurs.
You know, lighter 5%ers.
See, I'd recommend not a red wine.
Like, anytime's a good time for an old time.
Mm-hmm. Probably white or rosé if you're feeling comfortable enough to drink a rosé in public.
About Jeff.
Yeah. And you should.
Enough, yeah.
You should.
Yeah, it's about pacing yourself. And the good thing about wine is
I'll drink a rosé.
You can sip a wine and people won't judge you, I think, bartenders especially, whereas a beer is if you're not.
Oh, good point.
If you're just letting your beer set for 5 minutes because you're like, I need to make it to halftime before I get my next one.
Yeah.
Also, don't ever let anybody that's drinking like a 4% Miller Lite
ever
give
judge
you shit about drinking a 12% rosé.
Anything? In life?
In life, yes. Sorry for my language.
No, you just got to let it roll off your shoulders.
You got to let it go. Like, yeah. That's ridiculous. You're like, dude, this wine will kick that beer's butt. You know what? Yeah.
Cool, dude. Like, I'm going to go get my girlfriend's Mercedes and roll home with
that's
my back.
My girlfriend.
Which leads into.
I might be a little spoiled.
The next question.
What are you drinking when you're fixing a German car? I can tell you. Anything that's high alcohol content. Because those cars drive me insane. What about you, Jeff? When you're fixing a German car, what are you drinking?
Hypothetically. My car is Japanese. But
oh, Japanese, I'm not drinking. Like, it's fine. No, I can get old time and get through that.
No, I love a good German Riesling, like Rhine Valley. You know I love Austrian wines, which is cheating, but they speak German, so it's
well, Austrian would be drier than the German. German would be a little bit more off dry.
Yeah.
I'm going to pull Steve here because I am, you know, German-blooded. And if I'm working on a German car, I'm going for a stout. I just need a nice, dark, bitter beer to help my soul while I work on this bitter car.
It's situational, right?
It is situational.
Like, that's what people like. When I mowed my lawn, I was like, I just mowed the lawn. They're like, oh, what wine are you drinking? I'm like, I'm drinking a beer because you don't drink wine after mowing the lawn. You drink beer.
Hold on. Maybe we should go mow a lawn. Yeah. Try to pair it with different wines.
That's a good episode idea, yeah.
So what are you drinking when you're sitting on the porch during summer? My guess is a rosé, now that I've talked to you quite a bit.
You might drink that Hillinger, a Hillinger Secco.
Yeah, the sparkling rosé here is amazing. That's very good. I mean, honestly, I think in the hot weather, maybe like more of an off-dry white is
also
good. You don't really want a really acidic white if you're just like outside.
Oh, I do. I like a really acidic white at all times.
Yeah. I can see this.
That's what depends on like, what. I mean, it might be, if it's cool in the evenings still, which, you know, we used to have that prior to climate change. We would get. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I got like a Pinot Noir.
Oh, fair enough.
Like, you can do reds.
I agree with
you. Can
that.
Do reds on the porch as well.
Yes, I am definitely a red guy, and I would go for a lighter or light
but
to medium body.
Let's be clear. It's going to be like
noon, August, DC. Yeah. I want something that's practically a popsicle. Is what I want.
It's over chilled white. But we are tomorrow it's going to be like 80 and we are drinking a lateral of Hawks.
Yes, but my air conditioning will be on in my house. Yeah. And as you've been there, you know that you can hang meat in my house when the air conditioning's on. Yes.
So this is gonna be
I don't like
one
being
for,
hot.
This is going to be a good one for Jeff. What wine do you love to drink but haven't?
Well,
now you have.
Thank you to Zena. I've had one of my bucket list wines. Yeah, this Amarone's amazing. I guess Barolo obviously is the other one. It's like the other.
Oh, guess we got to do another guy talk.
Barolo is very good.
Don't spend Barolo money on me. Come on.
Oh, no, we will.
We could do. It's about the same. To be honest, they would be both about the same retail price.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those are like the two big famous Italian reds. Like
I love
the,
a good
from the two regions I love. So
yeah. I think when we went to Salt and Vine, we had a Barolo.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. I actually, when I went with my parents, I got the same bottle of Barolo. It was delightful. So my dad and I enjoyed it very much. My mom.
Your dad likes a Barolo. Your mother goes for a sweeter wine.
He definitely goes for a sweeter wine. She's like Concord, right?
Yeah.
Church community.
Little
wine.
Manischewitz style for your mom. Yep.
Love you, Mom. So final question for me. Do you think it's okay to drink wine from a coffee mug? I'm going to start with this. My answer to that is, heck yeah. I'll put it in a coffee mug. I got no problem with that.
Yeah, I hate to be really rational about this. Like, what difference would it make?
I agree with you.
Especially if you have kids around you.
Well, I am a little picky. I've learned, and box wine's okay. That's the exception. I don't really like drinking wine out of plastic.
No.
Yeah.
It does change.
We'll do a wine glass. We're going to have to do a wine glass episode.
It's actually a really fun thing. And we did it once at my friend's house where it was a plastic cup, like a clear plastic cup.
You get nothing out of a plastic cup.
Like a red Solo cup, a metal cup, and then a glass.
Mm-hmm.
And it can change. I mean, from the technical standpoint, it can change the difference. If you're at an Airbnb and they don't have wine glasses and you've got wine,
I might just drink it straight out of the bottle, to be honest.
Right.
At that point.
A water glass. I mean, the Italians drink it out of a water glass, right? Like, Italians and the French will drink it out of, like, a water glass. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
If you're having, like, a really special wine and you want that, then you would want a more of a proper glass.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day...
You know, if you have kids, you're drinking something out of a
sideways. Yeah, like you can have a sippy cup as long as it gets in there. But plastic is going to change. Plastic is going to change it. So if you can get like even one of those insulated metal ones that have glass on the inside, it's going to taste better.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to taste better.
Embarrass my father for 1 second.
Yeah,
sure,
please.
Go for it.
So
best part of the podcast.
When I came back from Japan, I brought my father a very expensive bottle of sake. It was like the famous local brewery from the prefecture I was in, which now is pretty famous in America. But back then, no one had ever heard of it, right? So I bring in this nice bottle of sake. Doesn't drink it. He's not a huge drinker, which is fine. So time goes by, and then he finally calls me up. He's like, oh, we finally had that sake you got. You're like, yeah, we're all in the garage. We were putting it in styrofoam cups, and we all thought it was terrible. And I'm just like, you put this expensive sake in styrofoam cups?
I'm like, that's a movie.
No wonder it was terrible.
As we're getting to this question, as Pink once said, she sent a bottle of Chateauneuf-du-Pape to her mother, and her mother said, it tastes just like what you get in the store, the grocery store. And she goes, cork it and send it back.
Cork it and send it back.
I like a $300 bottle of wine or something. So.
All right, so we have two last questions. I'm going to start with the first one. Finish this sentence, Jeff. Wine is best when?
You're with people.
I love that. That's perfect. What a great ending.
I 100% agree with that.
All right, and...
There we go.
What is our final thing? What is your favorite Pink song?
I came up with a good one.
Okay.
Tell us.
You laughed last time. Just Give Me a Reason.
Yes.
That song is great.
That is a great summer song. Do you have another one this time?
I do have another one. Oh. You know I like her covers.
Yeah.
And I'm going with White Rabbit.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to cheer us out. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Cheers. Cheers.
Thank you so much, Jimmy, for doing Guy Talk with us. We really enjoyed this. We still have, we all down the Amarone. We still have a little Chianti Classico to go. So.
Yeah.
We will see you at our next episode. Thank you so much, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
That was hysterical. That happened.